This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on beleaguered Lebanon. The deadly explosion at the port of Beirut on August 4 left approximately 180 people dead, injured 6,000, and displaced hundreds of thousands. 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate, which can be used as a fertilizer or as an explosive, was the proximate cause of the blast. And therein lies the underlying problem, say analysts: gross negligence and mismanagement by a corrupt regime. A week after the devastating explosion, Lebanon's Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned. Widespread protests in October 2019 forced the resignation of previous Prime Minister Saad Hariri. A broad cross-section of Lebanese, especially the youth, took to the streets to protest endemic corruption, the lack of basic services, as well as the current sectarian political system built on patronage networks. Well, what is next for a country that has seen far more than its share of tragedy? 20% of Lebanon's population are refugees, of which 1.5 million are Syrians. The country's currency, the pound, has lost 80% of its value since October. Analysts say the poverty rate is projected to reach 75% by the end of this year. The August 4 blast at the port of Beirut amplifies Lebanon's many crises. It exposed the fragile and corrupt condition of the Lebanese state, aggravated the dire conditions of the Lebanese economy, and exacerbated social inequities. According to the Wall Street Journal, COVID-19 has also highlighted the inadequacy of the healthcare system, which Isabel Cole explains was dealt a double blow by the explosion, which badly damaged six of the country's hospitals. Ordinary Lebanese have come to the rescue of each other, sweeping streets, taking in relatives and friends who have been abandoned or bereft by the blast. They are also renewing their calls for fundamental political and economic reform. Analysts say that most Lebanese would like to abolish the current power-sharing system. Groups such as Hezbollah, a Shia militia, and political party are coming under increasing scrutiny. Backed by Iran and considered a terrorist organization by the United States, Hezbollah will have to answer for its actions or inactions regarding Lebanon's calamitous conditions. After all, it is considered Lebanon's most powerful political and military force, and it cannot live on its reputation as the so-called resistance against Israel and provider of social services to its Shia constituency alone. According to the Washington Post's Liz Sly, who interviewed political scientist Hillel Kashan, quote, Hezbollah has become an impediment to the country receiving the international assistance needed to stave off further economic collapse, close quote. Just last week, a UN-backed tribunal in the Netherlands investigating the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri delivered its verdict. It found that Hezbollah member Salim Ayash was guilty as a co-conspirator in the Beirut bombing that killed Hariri and 21 other people. Well, for more on the crisis in Lebanon and prospects for salvation, we have two extraordinary regional analysts who are no strangers to these VOA microphones. Mona Yacoubian is senior advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And both panelists join us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol.
Mona, let me begin with you. Situate Lebanon for all of us. You know, even since the Ottoman Empire, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the French got involved. Syrians were managing the country for so many years. Give us a quick thumbnail which underscores its geographical and strategic importance in the region.
So Lebanon is a small country situated on the eastern Mediterranean. It was carved out of what was once called Greater Syria as part of the Ottoman Empire. It's a country that has been no stranger to difficult times, to war, both internally, a 15-year civil war, war with Israel. And these are people who have really seen their share of tragedy. I think what's really important, though, is to underscore kind of what you laid out at the beginning, which is this is a country now that is going through a catastrophe that, honestly, I think it's no exaggeration to say is of biblical proportion. in terms of how much the country suffered through a financial collapse, which has now precipitated a socioeconomic collapse. You have COVID surging. All of this was the case prior to the explosions earlier this month. And now you have the impact of that. It's a country, though, that's renowned, I think, for its diversity. It's a true mosaic of Christians, Muslims, something actually quite unique about it. And its stability is important from a U.S. perspective because, of course, of its location, it borders Israel. It's, of course, right next door to Syria. This is a country that if it were to fall into instability, I think it would have enormous implications for our own U.S. national security interests.
Well, that's certainly a very good point. And over to you, Hussein Ibish, with respect to the possibility of, because of the chaos, Lebanon falling into the wrong hands. The Russians are right next door in Syria, gaining greater influence in the region. You have Iran, which backs Hezbollah. Let me have your perspective of how important it is and the situation as we see it today, the tragedy in the aftermath of this blast.
For decades, maybe even from the beginning since independence, but certainly since the 1960s, Lebanon has been a playing field for international actors. And there is almost no Lebanese political party that doesn't have a foreign sponsor. So they all have two identities, so the local identity where they serve whatever constituency they serve in Lebanon and whoever they work for overseas. So this is a constant, but it's becoming more and more extreme as the state becomes more and more of a failed state. And the reason that the rest of the world is so concerned about that is Lebanon is going in two directions simultaneously. It's headed in kind of the direction of Gaza or even maybe like old Somalia, in other words, of a kind of really anarchic situation and a big draw for the most extreme terrorist groups, and not just Hezbollah, but also Al-Qaeda and ISIS and who knows who can get a foothold where there really is no state at all. See northern Syria, see western Iraq, etc. And additionally, Lebanon is headed in a Venezuelan scenario where hyperinflation has taken root for the first time in any Middle Eastern country in modern history, and the currency has collapsed. And there are many differences, but also many similarities between the Venezuelan collapse and the Lebanese collapse. So what you're looking at then is a country that is strategically important, that is contested between different camps, and that could easily sink into total and utter chaos, falling not only into the hands of the worst actors, but becoming a playground for the worst of the worst.
Back to you, Mona Yacoubian, for a reaction to what's going on right now, politically, economically, with the cleanup. Do you see any prospects? What are we looking at right now? The government resigned. Who's in charge? Are there promising prospects for any type of reform? Because it sounds like we can't get much worse at this point.
No, and I think Hussein sketched it out well. I think one other point for listeners to think about is this is a country that was once solidly middle income. And now you have, prior to these explosions, more than 50% of the population sinking into poverty. So we're seeing this middle class vanish before our eyes. The question to ask is whether or not this August 4th catastrophe, unfortunately, of the government's making, and I think we should underscore that this catastrophe could have been avoided. It is perhaps the most dramatic example of government corruption, ineptitude, disregard for its own people. And we can talk a bit more about why that's the case. As you noted, the government was already forced to resign. That's not going to be enough. But can this actually become an inflection point for Lebanon, a turning point, where all of the ills that have plagued this country for the last 30, 40 years can be addressed? And people are demanding nothing short of that. They are furious. They've demanded not just the resignation of the cabinet, but they want the parliament to resign. They want the president to resign. They're really saying it's no longer the case that they will accept business as usual. And so I think it's a very important question as to whether or not these catastrophic blasts can in fact be transformed into a moment of real change for Lebanon.
So what do you say to that, Hussein? Can this be an inflection point for change?
I think it could be, actually. I think the amount of failure, catastrophe, and tragedy that has accumulated one on top of the other since October, and even a little before that, is so great that it does threaten potentially to begin to unravel the tight grip of control by this corrupt and violent oligarchy that rules Lebanon. And specifically, the bedrock of it is Hezbollah, because Hezbollah's militia, even much more than the Lebanese army, is sort of the last gasp guarantor against change in the Lebanese system. Hezbollah benefits tremendously from the broken state Lebanon is. It allows them to have their own militia, their own foreign policy, their own defense policy, their own telecommunications network to control ports and the airport and all kinds of stuff that no properly functioning state would ever allow an armed gang to do. But that's exactly what they do do. So they are willing in the end to use violence to enforce this. However, the middle class has disappeared. Poverty is rampant. People are enraged. And there are all these pressures that have built up. So one is the economic collapse. Another is the total discreditation of the system and the protest movement, which began in October of last year, which is still, you know, not in any way abated, even though people aren't on the streets for various reasons. Also, the coronavirus pandemic, which is hitting Lebanon fairly hard and is one of the reasons why you don't see those crowds right now, but you otherwise would have. And then this incredible explosion, which has destroyed so much of the city. And when the government not only knew it was there, they were warned in July, a few weeks before, that an explosion of that material could destroy much of the city, so that they knew exactly what could happen and didn't do anything about it. And many people suspect they didn't do anything about it precisely because Hezbollah found it helpful to have all that huge stockpile of explosive material at hand in a part of the port near where they controlled. This combination of recklessness and fecklessness is just extraordinary. And now on top of that, you have this kind of split verdict today on the UN tribunal looking into the 2005 assassination of Rafiq Hariri, which found one Hezbollah member to be directly responsible and implied Syria and Hezbollah were responsible, but said they couldn't find any direct evidence. That too is a problem for Hezbollah. So the whole power structure and the main force behind it, which as I say is this pro-Iranian militia, are facing extraordinary pressures. Above all, they need a bailout from the IMF. They are negotiating a $20 billion bailout, the Lebanese state, to recapitalize the banking system and get the economy going again. They can't do it otherwise. So basically, the power structure is caught now between a set of concessions they desperately don't want to make, because once you start making reforms, you've opened the bottle and the genie's out. And other, if you can make one reform, why not another? And basically, it sets in motion a process that's very hard for them to control. But if they don't accept a bailout, there will be a total breakdown in society, and their ability to control it will be undermined by chaos, desperation, rage, and anarchy. So they're looking at basically accepting new terms from the world and then the Lebanese people, which they don't like, or jumping off a cliff. And I think they're going to take the terms.
We'll have more in just a moment, particularly about Hezbollah. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Mona Yacoubian. She's the senior advisor to the vice president of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. They join me via Microsoft Teams as we examine the political, economic, and strategic crisis in Lebanon. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Marwan Adebay from Sana'a, Yemen. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Mona Yacoubian, back to you. Let's pick up on what Hussein Ibish was saying about Hezbollah as a major impediment, perhaps, to political and economic reform. How do you see Hezbollah behaving with respect to the reforms that really must be undertaken if Lebanon is to survive?
I think Hussein is correct. And certainly Hezbollah has a big role to play in this. They've been very much opposed to implementing any of these reforms. Although I do think it's important to situate Hezbollah more broadly in this sectarian system of governance that includes certainly Hezbollah, but also sectarian leaders across sects in Lebanon. And so, yes, Hezbollah, but also other leaders as well. It's an entire system. And the Lebanese themselves even refer to this when they say when they want everyone to leave, they say all of them means all of them. Kulun ya'ani kulun. So they're really fed up with everybody, understandably so. I would agree with Hussein. Hezbollah is a huge impediment to this. And they are under growing pressure, no doubt about it. The question is how to push for change, for major systemic change, without completely destabilizing the country. And it's delicate because all of these sectarian leaders are clinging tenaciously to their perks, to their power. I would also agree with Hussein, though, that the country is faced, frankly, with no choice. There's no way out of this morass without negotiating some sort of financial rescue package with the IMF. The issue is, if Hezbollah, in my view, is put front and center of this as the problem, and if, for example, there's an immediate effort to try and disarm this militia, that would fail utterly. That will throw the country into anarchy and civil war. So how to move forward, how to, frankly, dismantle this sectarian system without throwing the entire country into disarray? And I actually think it's doable. And I think the first step would be that a new cabinet is appointed that is truly independent, that features their very sharp people in Lebanon. This is a country whose population is very skilled. That's not the issue. It's how do you have a cabinet that is not tied to any of the sectarian leaders? This is a time when pressure from below, from the grassroots, from people, and they are actually still protesting despite everything, as well as, I would argue, an unprecedented degree of leverage from the international community, precisely because of these dire financial straits. Can those two pressures be brought to bear to get this incremental, but I would argue important, first step of an independent cabinet with no ties to the sectarian leaders and one that's empowered to make exactly the kinds of reforms that are being demanded by the IMF and the international community more broadly? That, to me, is the best step that can be taken.
What say you, Hussein Ibish?
Well, I say yes. Oh, I agree entirely with Mona. I think that's exactly right. I would also add that it's very important not only to do this incrementally. I mean, disarming Hezbollah is something that will happen at the end of a very long process, if it ever fully happens. It'll be towards the final stages of a decades-long process. What I would look to after a new elections, which I think need to be held, of course, exactly as Mona suggested. But in addition to that, I think there is a framework within the Lebanese existing political framework for going very far in the direction you need to go to without creating anything new. There are two crucial documents, the Taif Accord and the Baghdad Declaration, which, if they were implemented, would go a long way towards curtailing Hezbollah's regional activity and towards making it a more normal political party in Lebanon. And then there are two articles in the Constitution which anticipate the move towards a post-confessional, non-sectarian political order in one case, and in the other case, it specifically calls for the creation of a non-sectarian lower house that would basically deal with the day-to-day operations of the country. And I would add, it's really important that MPs to that legislative body are directly elected by their geographical constituents. In other words, I think it's really important for political representation to be disconnected from subnational identity and made a function of a geographical identity, or perhaps even some kind of national proportional representation. But I would definitely much prefer the first. And so that you begin to decouple the way in which these sort of powerful subnational identities that fuel this parochial, feudal sort of fragmentation in the country, and have from the outset even. And you start to pick up on this old idea that was there at the founding of Lebanon and has somehow survived in the ideals of all these protesters who represent every constituency and community in the country, that Lebanon, while it was put together of a collection of little areas, sectarian and confessional and ethnic and regional groups, that it can and should transcend that to create a modern Lebanese political identity and sort of e pluribus unum, that out of many one can come. That has never happened. But, you know, as long as the public really believes in it, and I think since October we've had ample proof that the public does still believe in it, there's a lot to work with. And it's the only way to get out of this terrible system that we've been in that empowers the worst people in the whole country.
Back to you, Moni Yacoubian. Because the IMF will absolutely require fundamental economic and political reforms, walk us through each step. How do we get there? Who pushes and what's first? The elections, the formation of a cabinet, in order to transcend, as Hussein Ibish said, this confessional system of Christians, Shia communities, Sunni, which is no longer obviously working for the country.
Right. Sort of to underscore this, the Lebanese people themselves are pleading with the international community not to give money directly to their government because of how corrupt the government is. That tells you something, given, frankly, the dire straits that the country's in. So, as I said, the first step is the appointment of an independent cabinet. That does not require elections. Those consultations are happening now between the presidency and the parliament. That's how cabinets are formed in Lebanon. The key is not to end up with a cabinet that represents essentially business as usual, you know, a musical chairs of sorts where the sectarian leaders simply put someone else in. The first step is to have a truly independent cabinet that is empowered to undertake legislation. And here, the IMF has issued a very clear roadmap, as has a group that's been led by France that goes back even a couple of years before, the CEDR conference, which has also put some $11 billion of assistance on the table for Lebanon. The country has yet to be able to unlock it because it has refused to undertake anti-corruption measures, dealing with a bloated public sector, dealing with a poorly governed electricity sector. There are a number of reforms that are very clearly spelled out that such an independent cabinet could undertake. It's also important to establish a robust social safety net in the country because of this growing impoverishment of the Lebanese people. And then there perhaps could be a move toward early parliamentary elections that are currently slated for 2022. That's a huge agenda to try and achieve. And you know, I certainly, as an analyst watching Lebanon, have no illusion, or anyone watching the Arab world, we have no illusions about how difficult this is. In some ways, I think the tragedy of the Arab Spring popular protests, which is how do you translate leaderless peaceful protests? How do you galvanize those into political leadership that can actually undertake the kinds of steps and reforms that need to be taken? That to me is a very difficult question, but that's what needs to happen. And again, I think if there could be some connective tissue between an international community that actually has real leverage right now on Lebanon, and those people in the street, those very brave and very principled folks who are really asking for nothing less than a government that actually is protecting the interests of its people, I think that's where you can begin to get real movement.
So Hussein Ibish, you get the last word. Let's say we get an appointment of an independent cabinet. There's nothing in the Constitution, if I understood you correctly, that says that the political system has to be governed on a confessional basis, correct?
Yeah, it can be reformed. It is set up that way, no doubt. But there is a article in the Constitution that says the country is committed to working to get past that. None of that has been done. But yeah, so the reform that we're talking about is built in to Lebanese governing documents. So you add to that Taif and Babda, and you've really got a lot to work with. If you just implemented what's already been agreed to, you could go 90% of the way. And of course, the reason you have to do that, even though many people are saying, well, all international support and dealing should be with NGOs and bypass the government. When it comes to infrastructure, roads, electricity, ports, sewer, you need the government. And when it comes to negotiating with the IMF, you need a government. So unfortunately, the state has to be rescued because also, by the way, there are those in the United States who say we should not support the Lebanese state because Hezbollah is very powerful within it. And so if you support the Lebanese state, you're supporting Hezbollah. That's true as far as it goes. But what it misses is the Lebanese state is the only alternative to Hezbollah domination. I think insofar as we can not only decouple the state from the corrupt politics and the sort of kleptocracy and thugocracy that we've been describing here, and make it realize its own already articulated vision for a post-sectarian future, but also create a strengthened state. One of the reasons things are as they are is that the institutions are non-functional and they are thoroughly corrupted and and in the hands of these bad actors. And so both things need to be done.
Well, for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter, a terrific conversation, which we hope to continue in the near future about Lebanon. I'd like to thank my guest, Mona Yacoubian. She's senior advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Encounter was produced here in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.